To any and all means compatible with the purposes of this corporation.
To promote the study of political and economic problems.
And of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends, right. Listeners. This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. Now, as we all know, there's a lot going on to talk about, and we've got, I think, a couple of good topics today that are right on the mark. And as usual, Maria, I wish you'd let our listeners know if they stay tuned what they're about to hear.
I would love to, Jim. Thank you. Well, today in our first half hour, we'll be speaking about the efforts of the establishment to silence critics of Israel's war on Palestine on school campuses, including right here in L.A. Our guest will be Stephen Rohde. And then in our second half hour, we'll talk about the lobby of mega-rich real estate developers in the Bay Area who are dead set on recalling three democratically elected women of color. We'll be joined by Cynthia Chandler, policy chief for the Alameda County District Attorney's Office, and her boss, DA Pamela Price, is one of the targets of those recall efforts.
Well, all right. Well, let's get to it. As our listeners know, certainly, vast numbers of students all around the country and now returning to their colleges and university campuses are discovering that in their absence, college administrators have been, well, busy devising new and, frankly, more restrictive rules governing protests and expressions of political viewpoints on their campuses. This is all inspired, of course, by this spring and summer's campus protests around the Israeli-Palestinian war. Here on the Lawyers Guild Show, we believe that this is a consequence on the part of college administrators and American society at large, having failed really to understand and acknowledge the distinction between anti-Semitic speech and action versus anti-Israeli speech and action. Excuse me while I take a sip of water. I have a bit of a frog in my throat today. So our topic today was inspired, though, by an article that our guest wrote for the LA Progressive online magazine. It's entitled Silencing Palestinian Voices on UCLA's Campus, having to do with a recent court decision that, as our guest writes, resulted in an, I quote, one-sided injunction stemming from UCLA Gaza protest that ignores pro-Palestinian voices and the violence committed against them. Now, the court decision he was referring to was issued on August 13th by U.S. District Judge Mark Scarsi in Los Angeles in the case of Frankel versus Regents. Our guest for this topic, of course, is our go-to expert on legal matters, especially legal matters having to do with constitutional law. He is Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, constitutional scholar. He regularly writes book reviews for the Los Angeles Times Review of Books. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, popularly known as ICUJP, which was formed in the wake of 9/11 for the purpose of organizing faith-based communities to call for an end to war and violence. Steve Rohde is also the past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, the past chair of Death Penalty Focus, and the past chair of Bend the Arc, the Jewish Partnership for Justice. Of course, he is only speaking for himself today, not for those organizations. Well, Steve Rohde, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friend.
Thank you, Jim and Maria. It is always a genuine pleasure to be with you.
All right. Steve, before we get to what you have deemed to be a very bad decision in the case of Frankel versus Regents, tell us, what is the factual background of the case? Who were the plaintiffs that filed the lawsuit against the regents? And what was their factual and legal claim?
Well, this case is set against exactly what you described, what we anticipate is a renewal of protests. Last year, there were protests at over 450 colleges and universities around the country. But even that doesn't tell the true story, which is that the Israel's war in Gaza has now exceeded 40,000 Palestinian deaths, including 17,000 children. There's no ceasefire in place. Israelis are still held hostage. The humanitarian crisis worsens every day. 500 or more Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. And the prospects of a diplomatic solution is simply far away from us. So we are going to have these protests, but have we learned everything over the summer? And unfortunately, in this particular lawsuit, I believe it's a step back. So in June of 2024, three Jewish students sued UCLA and UCLA only for violations of their federal constitutional and civil rights under the free exercise of religion clause. It is totally focused on an allegation of religious discrimination. Basically, they allege that the university had failed to protect them after pro-Palestinian protesters established an encampment on the university campus. That was done back in April. A group of pro-Palestinian protesters occupied a portion of the campus known as the Royce Quad. They established a Palestinian solidarity encampment. The court states in its facts that they protesters set up checkpoints and required passersby to wear a wristband in order to cross into the encampment. Only citing news reports, the court said the encampment entrances were guarded by protesters and people who supported the existence of Israel were kept out of the encampment. So the court said that the three Jewish students asserted that they have a religious obligation to support the Jewish state of Israel, and they concluded that by being excluded from the encampment because they were Jews, that that violated their rights. Now, no one can quarrel with the right to be free from unequal treatment based on religious status. That's a key to the free exercise clause in the First Amendment. It's something I have defended in my legal career and others would. The problem, which we'll get into, is that because the entire defense was mounted by UCLA lawyers and no one speaking for the Palestinian and pro-Palestinian students, UCLA failed to point out to the court that these plaintiffs were not subjected to unequal treatment and were not targeted for special disabilities based on their religious status. So that was how the case was teed up for decision.
Well, let's talk about that decision, how the federal court ruled and what it based its ruling on and what are sort of the effects of it.
Well, in the end, the court did issue a preliminary injunction. They credited the plaintiff's allegations because UCLA didn't really put up a defense. UCLA raised technical defenses, such as that UCLA was not responsible for what the protesters did, but the plaintiffs were arguing it was what UCLA didn't do. And they argued that an injunction looking to the future wasn't appropriate because the protests were over and there was no risk of future violations of the students' religious rights. The problem is, and so the court issued what I called a tepid injunction. It's the kind of injunction that says, follow the law. You really don't need to bring a lawsuit to get someone to follow the law. They should follow the law. And so all the court said is you can't have a university-endorsed activity if Jewish students are excluded from that activity. And if that was what happened in the past or what's happening in the future, I don't think we'd be doing this radio interview, because nobody wants people excluded from endorsement or university activities based on their religious beliefs. But that's not what actually happened last year. And that's why it took other people to speak up.
Yeah, Steve, and you write, of course, that in your LA Progressive article, and I quote again, a state violates the free exercise clause when it excludes religious observers from otherwise available benefits. But what you've said now in this lawsuit, we're going to expand on that, is that the court, though, had nothing before it. It had the allegation from the plaintiffs that this had happened to them, that they had been excluded from this camp because of their religious status. And the defendant in the case, who you would have thought would have offered some evidence to the contrary if there was evidence to be offered, failed to argue, in fact, that the plaintiffs were never, in fact, subjected to any unequal treatment, and that they were not, in fact, as you write, targeted for special disabilities based on their religious status. And you go on to say that it was only the friend of the court, amicus brief, when you think of it that way sometimes, that was filed on behalf of the UCLA chapter of Faculty for Justice in Palestine that put forth any facts, the true story, really, of what really happened. But the court was under no obligation, of course, to consider that brief. So talk to us about, well, why do you think UCLA presented nothing else? Why did they not pay any attention, really, to the amicus brief? Explain that to our audience as well. And what was, in fact, the many points, and this is what I think I want you really to talk about, in that amicus brief, and you'll tell us who that organization really is, they offered a goodly number of facts in support of the defense and against what the plaintiffs were arguing, did they not?
Well, exactly. And, you know, this is a problem in our adversary system. You have a plaintiff and a defendant. UCLA was no friends to the pro-Palestinian protesters, so they weren't the ones who were going to speak up for them. So across the country, there is a organization, Faculty for Justice in Palestine, FJP. They described themselves and identified and told the court they were a diverse, multi-religious, multi-generational, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, and multidisciplinary collective of faculty members at UCLA, including both Jews and Muslim members and others. They explained that their members have faced significant harms while exercising their First Amendment rights. Faculty members at UCLA were beaten, arrested, doxxed. They've had their civil rights violated and sustained physical injuries and faced serious administrative retribution while acting to support the students who were speaking out against war crimes and human rights violations. Mm-hmm. So they filed the brief to try to bring to the court's attention that expressing criticism of genocidal acts, which have been the subject of international tribunals and are funded by U.S. taxpayer money, is not anti-Jewish. In fact, it's vital, they allege, to a vibrant university life and democracy to have the space to make those arguments, and that protesting human rights violations and genocide is not anti-Semitic. They had to bring facts before the court as much as they could based on publicly available information. And anyone reading the court decision would be surprised. And one of the reasons I wrote the article, you know, who goes into the court records to read an amicus brief? I wanted to give attention to the fact that this encampment of pro-Palestinian anti-genocide protesters included Jews, including members of If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace and other religions, and that in fact their rights were being violated. So the amicus made several points. It said it is not true that anyone was denied entrance to the encampment based on their identity. The UCLA Jewish Voice for Peace affirmed in an official statement that, like other members of the campus, they were welcome. These Jews were welcomed into the encampment. Entrance to the encampment was contingent on principles, politics, and solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, not on identity, and that many Jewish students, including members of JVP, were active participants in the encampment. Now, I want to quickly cite one other source for this. This was not just the opinions of this faculty group or others. UCLA, when this issue arose, appointed a task force on anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim, and anti-Arab racism. It was a UCLA task force. They found that Muslims, Jews, Christians, and followers of other faiths, as well as atheists, were welcome into the encampment. Muslim Salat and Jewish Shabbat were commonplace. And they also independently cited a letter from 78 Jewish faculty members that Jews who support the liberation of Palestine should not be devalued, and that their voices were equally important. Finally, the amicus brief pointed out that on April 30, pro-Israel counter-protesters violently attacked the encampment. According to UCLA's own task force, they came armed with bear mace, chemical irritants, hammers, knives, stink bombs, high-grade fireworks, baseball bats, metal and wooden rods. They attacked the encampment. Men in full-face white masks were breaking down the barriers using knives and hammers. One armed with a long metal rod would try and pierce people and bash them. That was the attack that actually went on. The UCLA security stood by silently. The LAPD stood by. That is the biggest violation of civil liberties and civil rights that's taken place on this campus. The court put that aside. It wouldn't address those interests, and it wouldn't give voice to the facts as the amicus brief described them.
Well, Steve, I understand there is a footnote in the ruling. The court acknowledged an important 2003 Supreme Court ruling that's relevant to the case at hand. What Supreme Court case did the court note, and what was the holding?
This was what was so disappointing, because this judge looked like he understood that if the right arguments had been made, if the right facts had been brought forward, may have issued a different kind of decision. The court itself said that, as he saw it, because of the facts he was given, this case is not about content or viewpoint contained in any protest or counter-protest slogans. Well, it was, actually, and that's what the encampment was about. He cited a prominent 2003 Supreme Court decision that said the hallmark of protection of free speech is to allow free trade in ideas, even ideas that the overwhelming majority of people might find distasteful. And another case that said if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it's that government, UCLA is an arm of government, may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds it offensive or disagreeable. I believe there was fertile ground if UCLA had made the right factual and legal arguments to have presented a far different result than came out in this case.
Yeah. Before we move on with that, thank you for that. And it's all the more important that you wrote this article, Steve, and I thank you for it. And I might make a plug as well for the L.A. Progressive. It's all the more reason why we ought to be damn happy in this town that we have the L.A. Progressive. Oh, the L.A. PD, excuse me, the L.A. Times, of course, covered the violence, quote unquote, and covered, you know, that made it look like it was a mess, but it didn't get into what Steve got into. And the L.A. Progressive was decent enough to print this article. I don't know the judge, so I can't comment on him. The larger fault and why this case was so one-sided and so bizarre in a way is because UCLA, for reasons that you suggested before, Steve, didn't really want to defend the case. Their sympathies really lay with the plaintiffs. So the defendants, the real defendants in this case, of course, were the students, the protesters, who were accused of violating based on religion and what have you. They wanted Jewish students. They wanted more Jewish students to be in it. Talk to us about all of that, Steve. It's really annoying, isn't it?
I want to. And I'm going to publicly credit Mark Kleinman and Thomas Harvey, who wrote this amicus brief. I am hopeful they will stay in the case. The preliminary injunction is being appealed. This is only a preliminary injunction. There will be a trial in this case. And I hope I've gotten across that when the students had the encampment, there was such fear of exactly what did happen, which was they were attacked, that they set up wristbands to ask, are you in political alignment with our views in condemning what Israel is doing and supporting Palestinian rights and Palestinian sovereignty? They did not set up a set of criteria that said, if you are Jewish, you cannot be admitted into the encampment or cross the encampment.
Like the opposite.
In fact, there were Jews in the encampment. So it literally disproves the essential element of a discrimination case is that you are discriminated on the basis of, in this case, your religion. And you cannot come out of the actual facts in this case with that conclusion. I think the judge was taken up by stories, other stories of anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews, which should be condemned. But that this case was about a specific encampment in which a political standard was being applied. And I hope if it's well briefed, especially if the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court will listen to the amicus briefs that are filed, they will see that the preliminary injunction was groundless.
Yeah, and there's been, in my judgment, and in the judgment of scholars who have studied this, a growing knee-jerk reaction to the pro-Palestinian protest to assume that they are driven in the main by anti-Semitism. And therefore, anything they do is considered to be anti-Semitic. So, of course, they must have wanted to keep Jewish students out of their protest. Yes, Steve, I'm sorry.
Yep. Yes, and that's the tragedy of those college presidents last December,
yes,
who bollocksed, who fumbled their job. Of course, these were Republican House members who were badgering them, and all they wanted was publicity. They didn't care about Jewish students. They didn't care about anti-Semitism. They were badgering these universities. And what those presidents then and in subsequent appearances failed to get across, and which is infecting this debate to this very day and to the upcoming college semester, is the conflation of the criticism of Israel and virulent Jew-hating anti-Semitism. And it has distorted this whole national debate. And the reason I'm grateful to your program, to the beginnings of some glimmer of people speaking up on this, is that we've got to name that, and we've got to find ways to eradicate that form of virulent Jew-hating anti-Semitism and give not use that label to name the powerful political criticism of what Israel is doing in Gaza. If we continue to blur those lines, as this court did, we are in for some ferocious repression of dissent on our college campuses this fall.
Well, I want to ask you in that regard, in terms of your fine article, because it also discusses the work and the opinion of the American Association of University Professors regarding freedom of thought and expression. But as we get into that, I'm reminded as you're speaking about this fall, already NYU, the very fine school, NYU, New York University, has created a new protected class on their campus of students. That protected class are Zionists, quote unquote. So if you criticize Israel, which is a Zionist country, by definition, you are prejudiced against a protected class now at NYU. So I want your opinion on that, because I know you have one, but also talk to us about not only that, but in general, as you write, talk to us about your fear that we're likely to now, as you've hinted at, experience a growing, a speeding up of this kind of confusion of what is anti-Semitic and what is anti-Israel, and how that's going to impact what should be brave, robust, and you write, wide open debate.
Yes. And you mentioned the American Association of University Professors. For almost 100 years, this group has tried to defend academic freedom. We have our First Amendment, we have free press. In the university setting, it is elevated with a concept of protection for academic freedom. The AAUP spoke of freedom of thought and expression is essential to any institution of higher learning. And they recognized and have repeatedly said their views will be expressed that may be wrong, distasteful, or offensive, but the nature of freedom is to sift and winnow through those ideas. Specifically, they've said that the campus needs to be free and open. No idea can be banned or forbidden. No viewpoint or message may be deemed so hateful or disturbing that it may not be expressed. And it went on to say that what we need to do is foster freedom of thought and expression and encourage vigorous debate on all social, economic, and political issues. Now, you've put your finger on the next generation of suppression by using this term of Zionism. Now, I think the American people need a graduate course in the history of Zionism, a movement that came out of the 19th century, but that was quite diverse with lots of critics who believed that if Jews ever became a theocracy, it would be dangerous for Jews as much as everyone else, including the indigenous people living in the Middle East. Hannah Arendt and others opposed Zionism. There was a full debate in American and Jewish society.
Albert Einstein opposed it.
Einstein and many others. Yeah. So Zionism is a term that now mixes Judaism and statehood. And that's exactly the dilemma that Israel created in its own constitution, but more not so. Its constitution has lofty words about protecting minorities and all faiths. But in practice, and we have seen this under the Netanyahu government, I believe that Israel has lost its way, that they have become a theocracy, that they have two classes of citizenships within Israel, that they are an occupying force in both the West Bank and in Gaza. And this all didn't start on October 7. What October 7 did was unleash this brutal form. And if we don't dig deeper into what Zionism is, and if people are not allowed to debate Zionism as we would debate any other ism in the political spectrum, if we are silenced, if we're accused of being anti-Semites, I am a convert to Judaism. I was president of Bend the Ark, a Jewish partnership for justice, which in June broke its policy of being exclusively a domestic organization looking at economic and racial justice. It broke through because it could not stand what was in Gaza. And Bend the Ark called on Biden in June to hold back military support of Israel. So there is a vibrant Jewish view in America that opposes what Israel is doing in the West Bank and Gaza. Those Jewish voices are being marginalized and silenced, as well as in this case, the pro-Palestinian voices were silenced as well.
Well, yeah, I would argue the principal or the main organizers of some of the largest encampments and demonstrations on this issue have been, if not now, a Jewish organization, Jewish Voice for Peace. They understand this issue. There's not a uniformity among Jewish people that think Zionism is the way to go, or that think that what Israel is doing in Gaza is proper and right. And this business about the sensitivity on college campuses, a lot of it, as I realize, has changed, certainly in my life. Now, I went to college 103 years ago, but when I went there, the whole idea was you were supposed to be exposed to ideas that might scare the devil out of you or make you mad. Or, hey, I never thought about that before. Really? That doesn't sound right. That was what it was all about, and the give and take of that, and learning new ideas and challenging ideas and having debate. Now, obviously, there are certain kinds of limits you want, but not the kind of limit now that's being put on a vital issue, an issue of that's going on there. But Steve, we're going to take a very brief, I wish you could stay with us. I hope you can stay with us a little longer, and we'll explain why in a minute, in addition to just wanting to talk to you more. But we're going to take a quick station ID break, and then we'll be right back with you folks. So stay tuned.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind & Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
Hearing our music again, it's hard for you to hear. Well, you're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show here at KPFK. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, the co-hosts, and we're talking to the wonderful constitutional scholar and activist and author, Steve Rohde, about what's been going on with respect to college protests around Gaza. And we're going to continue with that happily for a bit, sadly and happily at the same time. Maria, explain why we're both happy and sad about that.
Yes. Well, there was a scheduling snafu, so unfortunately we won't be able to talk about the recall segment and the very wealthy mega real estate developers who are trying to fund the recall of three democratically elected women of color in Oakland. But we will be talking about that next week. So unfortunately, as you said, good news, bad news. Bad news is we're not going to talk about that today. But the good news is Steve Rohde can stay on just a little longer to keep talking because this is such a great subject. And as you're talking, I was thinking,
Maria,
about,
you're asking a retired lawyer if he's able to speak longer.
I don't think there's anything more to say.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I was thinking about that, what you're both saying about college campuses and how you not only are confronted with things that might be different from what you were told, sometimes you find things that are actually putting words to things that you've intuitively felt. Like maybe you're learning that, wow, you mean other people can also believe in peace.
Yes, I want to expand on that.
Sure.
But I also want to say that two thoughts can be held simultaneously. This came up right after October 7 and into the military assault by the IDF. I was challenged. You mentioned Interfaith Communities, United for Justice and Peace, my interfaith group that I'm so active in. And we had to grapple with how the grief and how heartbroken we were that innocent Israelis and Bedouins and others were killed on October 7. You can hold that thought to mourn the losses of the innocent people on that day and hold the thought that the entirely disproportionate genocidal response by Israel must be condemned. The prosecutor at the International Criminal Court is seeking authority to bring charges both against Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas leaders, each separately, for any crimes against humanity that they are guilty of. And I think we cannot, and I think it isolates us to be accused by being defending the rights of Palestinians and the sovereignty of a Palestinian state, to then try to box us in as if we are insensitive to the loss of any innocent life. Jewish, Bedouin, foreign visitors on October 7, Palestinians and Jews and the like. So we need to name that and declare it. And then we equally need to name that none of that allows the silencing of those voices. And America falls into the habit of listening to certain prominent voices. The Anti-Defamation League has really undermined the principles of open and free debate in this recent period. And I'm proud again of Bend the Arc that went toe-to-toe with the ADL. You know, it's important, and that's why If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace are important, because you do need to demonstrate to the general public that there are Jewish voices on this side of the debate, and not allow the isolation of those arguments to be made in the way they are. So I think that's the battle that we face.
Yeah, I wanted to add something to that, and Maria, you reminded me of it too when you opened this part of the discussion. Maria, you can, I'm sure, remember when we had on Amina Kwasi. I remember that was right in the middle of all this was going. Now, Amina Kwasi is an attorney here in Los Angeles, Palestinian attorney. She used to work for CARE. She had a big shot job at CARE. She worked for the Lawyers Guild for a time. She's certainly very much behind the Palestinian cause, for heaven's sakes. But she told a story, and I know her well enough to know she doesn't BS. She told a story about being in the car one morning, listening to a mother talking about the loss of some of her family members. And then it came that they were lost on October 7th by the Hamas strike. And she began to sob at her car, crying for that mother and for all of those Jewish people who met that fate, and crying in anger because of what her people had done. And that and other things inspired me to write it's been a couple of months ago now, an article which again was published in the wonderful LA Progressive. It was entitled, "But Is It Good News for the Jews?" And I talked about an old Jewish friend of mine who, whenever you'd hear, okay, somebody robbed a bank, somebody murdered somebody, he'd say, "Oh, God, I hope it wasn't a Jewish guy." because he knew, and I've heard the same thing from Muslim friends and from Black friends, because the prejudice against Jews, the real anti-Semitism that exists, the real racism that exists, when somebody does that, everybody, they all get blamed. Just like when I'm just an old white guy. Some white guy robs a bank. I don't say, geez, I hope it wasn't a white guy. Actually, I do hope it was a white guy, because I figure he'll get less crap and be treated more fairly if he's innocent than will somebody of color. But it's the same point. And there is anti-Semitism in the movement. And the Jewish groups that organize these protests are the first ones to call it out and to condemn it. They have every right to be just as angry about false accusations of anti-Semitism and college rules which limit their rights to engage in what should be understood as legitimate free speech. But Steve, also, I'm thinking here, and Maria mentioned it to me too,
and
the journalists. Look what's happened to the journalists there. Now, you had something else to say. Go ahead. But it's all a sad story. We should probably cover more than we do. But go ahead, Steve. I'm sorry.
Well, just briefly on that, and then I want to sort of what we would say call an action item at the end.
Good. No, better yet.
I did it. I was asked by Truthdig, the online publication, to look into the killing of journalists. It is tragic. These numbers are probably higher than they are a few weeks ago. 116 Palestinian journalists have been killed since October 7. That exceeds the numbers of journalists killed in many of our world wars and other armed conflicts around the world. And in that article in Truthdig, I tell the story of two Palestinian journalists who were targeted, whose vehicle was identified. They were covering the war. Their vehicle was identified, was targeted, and was attacked by IDF missiles. And the excuse was that these journalists were the mouthpiece of Hamas. That's the kind of phrasing by the IDF. In other words, if a journalist is expressing even viewpoints, whatever they are, by one side in a conflict, now those journalists are legitimate targets for, I have to call it assassination, in the sense that they knew who they were and they targeted them individually. And I said in that piece that killing the messenger is the most effective form of censorship. That is the ultimate censorship, is to kill journalists who are trying to cover the story. It's being condemned by international human rights groups, by Reporters Without Borders and other press organizations. It's a story, another story that doesn't get enough attention. And you would think that our lofty corporate mainstream media would care about their own and would identify that. And I'll quickly add that another group is pointing out scholasticide. Scholasticide is the destruction of Palestinian universities and schools, targeting, eliminating every Gazan University and schools throughout Gaza. They are systematically being destroyed. I hadn't really focused on the term scholasticide. It's genocide of schools. So that is taking place. Have you seen that?
I heard reference to it, but you just told me all I know about it. Yeah. That's the point.
So that has to be identified. And one thing I'm so proud of is the work that we've been doing at ICUJP, because right after October 7, we grabbed a hold of this, and I'm giving a plug for ICUJP.org, We meet every Friday morning at 7:30 a.m. on Zoom. You can get the invitation online, join us. And because of Zoom, we have reached out. We had a Palestinian speaker who works for the American Friends Service Committee, a legendary Quaker organization that's been working for peace and humanitarian aid. He joined us last Friday. A few weeks back, we had an extraordinary woman, Hadib Tarifi, formerly on the board of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. She came to us a few months ago, and by then, she said she had lost 125 family members in her extended family in Gaza. And so it's timely to say that ICUJP is honoring Hadib Tarifi, a wonderful young man, Tahil Sharma, who is a Sikh activist, and Simone Zimmerman, one of the founders of If Not Now, at our annual George Regas Courageous Peacemaker Awards this coming Sunday, September 8, from 3 to 5 at Holman United Methodist Church. We are honoring the founders of ICUJP, people that I know the both of you have known and spoken to over the years. Our convener was George Regas, an extraordinary Episcopalian minister from All Saints Church in Pasadena. He was joined by Rabbi Leonard Bierman of blessed memory, Jim Lawson. We lost Reverend Lawson this year, and Dr. Meir Hatut of the Islamic Center of Southern California. Those were the four pillars of the founding of ICUJP, and by now we've lost all of them. We'll be recognizing their legacy and paying tribute to them as much as we pass the torch to this younger generation of Muslim, Christian, Sikh, and Jewish leaders and humanists in this work. And anyone who's interested can support that event. Join us at Holman United Methodist Church on Adams from 3 to 5 this coming Sunday, and simply go to icujp.org to get all of the details. It's a free event. We are asking if you can afford $25 at the door. We believe it will be a moving event and something that is an opportunity to tell these stories. It is telling the stories, just as you said a moment ago, because unless we humanize these conflicts, even as I started today's conversation and speaking of 40,000 Palestinians killed and 17,000 children, those are shocking numbers, but you cannot tell the story of each one of them. And when you tell the story of any one of them, and when you are able to communicate the humanity of this, as time permits, there's one final story that George Regas told us.
Well, I only wanted to say on your behalf and on behalf of ICP in general, that it was my honor to know all of those lost heroes that you mentioned. And I certainly knew them well enough to know that they would be thrilled with how Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace has carried on. You know, sometimes you have that expression, somebody must be spinning in their grave. Well, George Regas must be, you know, having champagne every night in his grave because of how wonderful that organization that he started is doing. He'd be thrilled and proud to death. You guys just do some wonderful, and women do some wonderful work. So I wanted to say that. But secondly, I also I had a question, and it occurred to me, and because we did find ourselves with this extra time of the show today, it gives me a chance to, and you mentioned, I knew this, that you were not born Jewish, that you converted to Judaism later in life. One of the things to me, as I was born into a Christian family. I'm an atheist, but I mean, I was, you know, so I'm not Jewish either. But one of the things that always along, and the older I get, the more it drives me crazy. I was always fascinated from, because I went to a Jewish high school and Jewish friends and married a Jewish woman. And so I've always been obsessed with the Holocaust. There's never a movie. There's never a book. I always, and I'm always, as so many people are, just left with horror and wonder, how could humanity possibly do this? And then, though, when I see Israel treating and committing genocidal acts, in my judgment and the judgment of, again, people who study this much more closely than I do, on the Palestinian people, I'm always left with the question, you of all people? I mean, you're the people that should know better than anyone else living on earth what it means to have this kind of a fate. So certainly that's why the leadership of the movement for Palestine are Jewish people. So I'm not trying to paint a one-sided picture, but to the extent that Israel is doing what it is being criticized for doing, and it is a Jewish nation, that always drives me nuts and depresses me, because I just wonder how you, maybe having gone from one to the other, might think about that.
Yes. Well, briefly, and I am grateful we have a little extra time today. I grew up in Long Island. I had a lot of Jewish friends. There was something, as I began to read and study more deeply, about the essence of Judaism, the concern for the stranger in Judaism, the concern for justice, 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 as the Torah says, the concern for racial equality and the growing movement in the world, in Russia, and then later in the United States. And so I was attracted to Judaism. I did a course of study. I converted to Judaism. I've raised my three kids Jewish, and it was the essence. I just had to fill out a survey, and I checked the box, secular Jew, because that captures my vision of my own spirituality and my own sense of Judaism. But you put your finger on it. I've said for decades, if there was a hypothetical country somewhere that was occupying, that had displaced another population, that occupied their land, that then built settlements elsewhere, moving into their land, then passed a nationality law establishing two levels of citizenship and law with civil courts for one and military courts for the other, if there was such a country, you would expect Jews at the front of the line protesting and rallying and exposing such a country.
I know.
And that's why, and there are Jews at the front of that line today, and we've mentioned them, and there are many more, and there are just humble, caring Jews sitting at home that aren't inclined to be active or join organizations, but who are aghast at what is happening. And what the Netanyahu government has done has caused danger for Jews around the world, because how did you put it, Jim?
This is not good news for the Jews, what they're doing.
Right, that's your point. They have inflamed the situation.
But it will. Yeah.
And the other thought we can hold simultaneously is that there is anti-Semitism in the world, and there is anti-Semitism within every political movement. We can't sugarcoat that. And we know that that exists. And that, too, should be dismantled and driven out. But you don't do it by having a state that declares itself a Jewish state, then committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and according to the International Court of justice, the judicial arm of the UN, plausible genocide in a detailed court ruling. This is not some wild rhetoric that the three of us are casting out or that other groups are casting out. It's a powerful term, and you invoked the Holocaust because of it. But we've got to simultaneously recognize that hating Jews as Jews and for nothing else than their religious beliefs is anti-Semitism. It is a form of bigotry. It's to be condemned as much as Islamophobia, as racism, as hatreds of blacks as blacks, or Muslims as Muslims. And you name that and condemn that. But then you must separately ask, in my case, what does it mean to be a Jew? What is our tradition that calls on us, especially in moments of great conflict? It's easy to do this work in peaceful times. It's easy to care for the stranger in peaceful times. It is when you are occupying a people. And the notion of Israeli self-defense needs to be examined. International law says that an occupying force has no right of self-defense over the occupied people. Right. In fact, it's the opposite. They have a duty of care and custody, a duty of protection of the occupied population, not to annihilate them and destroy them. There may be a day when, whether it's the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court under the Rome Statute, domestic laws, if a different government comes to power in Israel, there may be a day when there is accountability for what has gone on for 75 years, but in particular in this last 10 months. Yeah. There may be a day when justice rolls down and when true justice comes to be. And sooner than that, there may be a day when Jews and Palestinians, Muslims and Arabs realize that it is only by protecting the sovereignty of Palestinians and the sovereignty of peace-loving Jews in Israel that we will ever see any hope of long-lasting peace in that region. And people of peace must devote themselves to that.
Absolutely. Reminder, before we do say goodbye, oh, it is time to wrap up. I've lost, oh my goodness. Steve Rohde, so wonderful to have you with us today. I'm sorry about what happened earlier, but we'll get that topic next week. But it's been a joy for Maria Hall and I to have this extra time to talk to you about this controversial, troubling, deeply important subject for not only the people of Israel and Palestine, but for the people of the world, and certainly here in the United States, where we're sending so many arms and what have you to Israel. So until next week at the same time, though, we thank all of our listeners for joining us today. The Lawyers Guild Show will be back with you next week, but until we are back with you, as the song is about to tell you, don't forget to stand up for your rights, my friends.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
Support comes from the Canyon Club in Agoura Hills, presenting Don Was and the Pan Detroit Ensemble. Sunday, September 22nd, 2024. The band includes longtime collaborators, Blue Note Records artist Dave McMurray on sax and Eminem's Oscar-winning collaborator, keyboardist Luis Resto, plus a host of stellar jazz musicians from the city of Detroit. For more information and tickets, visit wheremusicmeetsthesoul.com and kpfk.org.
I'm Sergio Mionyshenko with the Global Village. Join me Fridays at 11 a.m. with music